couldn't think of a better introduction for this topic that we'll be handling for the rest of the night here on Coast to Coast than that last caller, who is an evangelist for somebody who it seemed like was a former Marine who, and thank you, by the way, for service to your country, who at least got part of the picture. He was talking about the abuses from the executive office in our government now, executive actions which are hard to justify, claims of near pontifical powers by presidents. It's been going on, though, for a lot longer than just this one. How long? How severe? And what are some of the most amazing examples of this? Plus, let's talk about the continuity of government articles and how that could affect all of us coming up in just a moment. First, a shout out to Ken, Aaron, Angela, Donna, the man on the street, and Richard Webb is on the web tonight, too, following me at Deacon Punnett. Love to keep in touch with you all that way. And I'll get to some of your Twitter questions, too, if you send them in from that account. We'll get to those all coming up on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well, Brian Toohey, it's always a pleasure. Many people might remember Brian from his book, The Fix Is In. And I know you always keep one eye peeled on professional sports and officiating and some of the subplots that we will hear about in sports radio and television. So before we get to disaster government, Brian, let me ask you about The Fix Is In first. Any good stories you've been following lately?
Take your pick, Ian. Which one would you like? Sports okay. Is filled with corruption.
Okay, come on, give it to me. What is it that? What do you think is another 4-star example of the fix of professional sports?
Well, I think one of the biggest ones you can point to, obviously, is the soccer match fixing scandal that kind of erupted recently, and that actually got coverage here in the United States, which is rare. And that, in that, for people who don't know, Europol and FIFA basically said that 680 soccer matches around the world had been fixed basically by organized crime and gamblers. And I think the key thing to take from all of that, and the thing that should matter to the people in the United States is of those 680 matches, the reason we know there's that many that have been fixed is because of legalized sports gambling. And that's the key thing is, because of legalized sports gambling, people who are betting on these fixed matches have to do it through legal sports books, and these legal sports books see strange betting patterns. They see the unnatural money that shows up on certain games. They report that to authorities. The authorities follow the money, and that's how they've been able to out these instances of game fixing in soccer. But here in the United States, because it's illegal, the only place it's legal really to bet on sports is in Nevada for the most part, nothing gets found out. So games that are being fixed today actively by organized crime and gamblers, and there are games being fixed today because I know I've talked to people in Major League Baseball even recently about potential fixed games, that it doesn't get uncovered here because no one's looking for it.
You know, I thought I remembered when that I follow soccer a little bit. I watch a certain amount of Premier League, and I'm a fan of the team, the London team, Arsenal. And I was, but I thought part of it was the whole thing was Asian corruption, wasn't it? Wasn't that the story at the time? Was it Asian ringleaders that were behind the so-called match fixing?
Well, that's one of the things they've really pinpointed, is that a lot of it comes from Asian organized crime because gambling is so intense in the Orient. But the interesting part of it is, and this researcher, this man by the name of Declan Hill, who wrote this great book about match fixing in soccer called The Fix, he pointed out that they know the main culprit probably behind this is a man by the name of Dan Tan. And the Singaporean authorities will not arrest this guy. Instead, supposedly, he's working with the authorities to out other match fixers. But that's like, you know, bringing in Al Capone, not arresting Al Capone, but having Al Capone point out other people who are breaking the law.
Well, but, and I mean, you, no sense. Except Al Capone would, like, I'm assuming this guy would too, is essentially eliminating the competition.
In very real, or he's giving them the low fruit, you know, the low hanging fruit.
Right. But I mean, he could be making his, you know, 5 years from now, that could be a real investment if you knock out the people at the top in your rival organizations, you know?
Exactly. And that's the scary part, is that they're trusting this guy as opposed to arresting him because they have plenty of evidence against him. They know that he's most likely fixed matches like in Italy and other countries in Europe. And these aren't small matches. I mean, we're talking like Serie A soccer in Italy is like their NFL. And this guy's supposedly fixed matches in that league.
Brian, too, let me ask you about the baseball player with whom you spoke recently, obviously without giving us any details.
It was actually Major League Baseball, not a baseball player.
But somebody within Major League Baseball.
Correct.
Who was telling you what?
Well, I interviewed, in researching for this next book that I have coming out on game fixing called Larceny Games, I interviewed like the former head of NFL security, Warren Welsh. And recently I talked to, his name's Dan Mullen. He's the head of the Department of Investigations for Major League Baseball. And I haven't gotten to fully, completely interview him like I would like to. But I do know that the Department of Investigations, which is only about a staff of 5 or 6 people for Major League Baseball, which means about 1 investigator for every 4 teams out there, that they have recently investigated, you know, potential instances of game fixing in Major League Baseball. Mm-hmm. And that's happened in the NFL, and it's happened in other sports as well. They just don't reveal this stuff.
Does that explain why the Cubs suck?
No, the Cubs have a different problem. I mean, they have a totally, totally different problem, and that's partially their fans, and it's partially Wrigley Field, because everybody shows up to go to Wrigley for the party, and they don't care what happens on the field.
You know, I worked for Tribune for a little while, and I was told that. Did I ever tell you this, what they told me at Tribune? Did I ever tell you this?
You may have. I'm not sure.
Okay. That it didn't matter whether it was a winning streak or a losing streak, as long as it was a streak. That that the fans will show up to Wrigley Field whether they're winning or losing anyway, just because to go to Wrigley Field and drink beer. And that but when it comes to like the revenue from radio and that the ratings would go up if the Cubs were losing 39 in a row or winning 39 in a row. And one of the reasons why Tribune, when I worked for him, they were completely transparent about the idea that they did not want to spend money on players to make a run for a championship, because it would actually ruin their business model, which was to keep the cost down, keep the profit margin high, because people were showing up and people were watching and listening to the games regardless of whether they won or not. So, yeah.
Well, that you just said, that's exactly why the Cubs never won anything in over 100 years.
Yeah. So they fixed from the inside. In this case, it's fixing like neutering. It's like
in a very real way. And we've seen other teams too. I mean, the Miami Marlins just basically dumped their whole roster this season after building this massive stadium because they don't want to field a competitive team, apparently.
Right. Interesting. Well, so on to the new book. Congratulations on Disaster Government, National Emergencies, Continuity of Government, and You. Is this available everywhere?
Not everywhere, but it is at Amazon. It's at Barnes & Noble. It's available for Kindle.
Okay.
I'm trying to get it out there to more and more outlets, but those two biggies so far.
Well, I hope the blurb I wrote for you on the back of the book isn't holding it back. So, you know, feel free to block that out or use a Sharpie and just kind of cross out my comments. But, you know, I think that's the interesting thing. When I was reading an earlier version of your argument in Disaster Government, is I love how much you do your research, and you're not just doing derivative stuff, or you're not just, you know, kind of the loudmouth guy at the end of the bar. You really do the heavy lifting here, trying to make your case. And I think you do it very effectively. We may be left to even get into some areas coming up when we get to phone calls later on that you didn't get to in Disaster Government, but I don't know what that is yet. Your argument in a nutshell is that this tradition of exploiting executive orders goes back to even before we were officially a country. Right. Yeah. I mean, Washington did this sort of thing that there has always been an attempt by presidents to use disasters or emergencies to manipulate the government and the powers of their offices while they could get away with it.
I think they were able to, they tried to do it and have been able to do it because disaster and what became known as a national emergency wasn't enumerated in the Constitution. So it's kind of a vague area, and that actually is more and more executive orders have been written and more planning has come about because of national emergencies. It gets more and more vague because it gives them more and more room to operate and do what they feel and do what they will. And that's why I think, like you say, dating back to the days of George Washington, he was able to get away with certain things, and really who really took advantage of it all and really pressed it was Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War.
Yeah.
And that's what changed everything. And really what people see as a problem today with Obama and executive orders really goes all the way back to what Lincoln did, because he was kind of the first one to issue strict executive orders, doing things that he shouldn't have been able to do constitutionally because of the emergency that was the Civil War, and basically because Congress allowed him to do it. And that's really the big problem, is Congress, they should have taken the power away from him. Like when he was basically issuing armies and issuing Navy, something that he doesn't have the power to do, and Congress retroactively okayed what he did.
Right.
And you that know, just started the slippery slope that got us to where we are today.
I there's references to that in the movie Lincoln, the Spielberg movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, where they even talks, he even talks about, like, I was doing stuff till they told me no. You know, I was just going to keep doing it till they stopped me. And I think that's what people don't realize is that every president, Republican or Democrat, has done this over the last, I mean, really, as you know, kind of honed the art under Lincoln, and not always for bad reasons. Sometimes, like in the case of Lincoln, he started creating his own, essentially creating his own government powers in the name of a national emergency, because Congress wasn't there to stop him, because so many people had stopped showing up at Congress because they had seceded.
Well, that's part of the problem with this whole issue in national emergencies and continuity government, too, is the fact it's kind of a double-edged sword, a lot of this information, because if you do have a true emergency, I mean, if we got into the Cold War and you've even today had, like, North Korea launch a nuclear missile at us, you don't have time for Congress to get together and come to some sort of conclusion on how to respond to what's occurring. You need
right.
someone to act now, and that, you know, the balls always fall into the president to do that. The problem is one of the things they discuss a lot of times in these programs and in these plans is what they call enduring constitutional government. And the problem with that is, or the irony with it is that many times the president and other people are going to act outside of constitutional bounds to respond to the emergency to supposedly ensure constitutional government. And is that right or is that wrong? It's hard to say.
Right. Except that, in the, I mean, I guess, you know, going back to Lincoln, and we can see a parallel underneath Roosevelt as well with what happened with FDR and the bombing of Pearl Harbor and the lining up of Japanese Americans and sending them into internment camps. But under Lincoln, that same thought that all of these different, you know, I mean, it sort of paranoia was at this at a heightened sense because, and we can look back and see maybe he wasn't so crazy to be so paranoid, but there really weren't systems in place that really could have stopped the threat that existed to the government. There weren't systems that could do it, so he was just kind of making it up as he went along as something presented itself, for right or for wrong. I mean, at least it seems like at the end of the day, the things which he was trying to do seem to be in order to keep the country together. Other presidents, maybe not so much. Things that they were doing was because they just wanted to do it and they didn't necessarily have any higher motives.
But yeah, I think that's true. I mean, Lincoln did seem to be kind of winging it in a very
yeah.
real sense. And I think later on, I think Teddy Roosevelt was one of the soon after Lincoln presidents who literally said, you know, if Congress isn't going to do what needs to be done. I've basically been charged by the people to do what needs to get done, and he started doing things himself through executive orders.
Right.
And FDR kind of picked up the ball, especially, like you said, during World War II, and he issued the most executive orders out of any president ever. And he was issuing them, like, I think the average, he averaged like 1.5 executive order for each day in office. He issued some, I think, gosh, I think I want to say it was like 3,000 executive orders during his time. And the trends just kind of kept continued because, again, Congress never took back the power that it should have. And by in effect, the executive orders have almost become laws. Even though legally they're not, they kind of act that way today. It's kind of a frightening thing because it is giving way too much power to the person sitting in the presidency.
Well, let's give an example of that, of what people think of today as being something that might even be constitutionally guaranteed, but it really isn't.
Well, I think really you could go right to the heart of the matter, and this is this national emergency thing. And I mean, I've asked people in other interviews, and I know you've read the books. I don't really want to ask you because you know the answer, but what is a national emergency? And the fact is it's an undefined term.
Right.
It's just something that supposedly the only closest definition never came from Reagan's era when he called it a national security emergency, which meant something that threatened national security could be deemed a national emergency. And the problem is if a national emergency is declared, and today, right now, we are under 25 separate national emergencies. It gives the president a lot of leeway to do things that he shouldn't be able to do.
Okay, but pause that. Wait. Pause that for a second because you need to amplify that. We are currently under 25 national emergencies?
By my last count at the end of 2012.
Okay. Yeah. Right. Okay. So I saw the on the list and broke down by presidencies. So what are the ones that are currently still active as national emergencies? This is the one where like it was like the Ivory Coast and Zimbabwe and other ones too.
Exactly. That's okay. The strange part of it all is, for example, the events of 9/11 are still a national emergency today.
So, okay.
But 12 years later, which they shouldn't be. That national emergency should have ended like the day or the day after. But what gets weirder is you get into, like you say, a situation in Zimbabwe is a national emergency. Situation in Iran is a national emergency. Situation in North Korea is a national emergency. Situation in Syria, in like the Ivory Coast and several other countries are considered national emergencies. But yet Hurricane Sandy was not a national emergency. Hurricane Katrina is not a national emergency. Earthquakes that happened on the West Coast are not national emergencies. And so it's really counterintuitive as to what is and what is not.
Well, and the Hurricane Katrina thing in particular seemed like it would be because of the threat that existed to our oil supply.
You would think so, but it wasn't.
Yeah.
I can't make this stuff up. That's the scary part of it all.
And what's the national emergency for Zimbabwe, the United States in Zimbabwe?
Well, who knows? Because it's not defined in the actual declaration. It's basically just the situation there could potentially threaten our national security here. And what I think it is and why all these different locales around the world have been declared national emergencies in the United States is it's basically a pretext for war. Because the Korean War, which wasn't really a declared war, was actually a national emergency declared by Truman. And that became the Korean War. And I think that's the same thing today, is it basically allows the president to set up a military action. And even more frightening is if you declare a national emergency by law, and I forget the exact law, but there is a law on the books, the president can operate under that national emergency outside of any budget constraints. So when you have a national emergency based on weapons of mass destruction or the terrorists that threaten the Middle East peace process, which are both national emergencies right now, he can spend untold billions of dollars on those national emergencies outside of any sort of budget constraints that may exist.
Okay. And when did we have about 30 seconds here. When did the national emergency for Zimbabwe in the United States, who enacted that? Was President Bush?
I believe it was Bush, and every year, which is by law has to be done, they're renewed every year. So it's been renewed by Obama at least four times now.
At least four times. How about that? Okay, but here's what I want you to do, and I'll give you a break to put it together, is come back and read all 25 of the national emergencies that we're currently under in the United States. It'll blow your mind. And then we'll get to some of the ones that aren't still national emergencies, which you'll remember, and what came about as a result of them, how they were manipulated. Coming up next, disaster government on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So we'll get back to disaster government coming up in just a second with Brian Toohey. Order his book by going to coasttocoastam.com. You can also find out more about my book, too, coming up. And thank you so much for ordering early. Makes me look good. And yeah, you know what? I think I might have, you know, I don't know whether it'll ever be a bestseller, but it's certainly getting a lot of attention from some very interesting corners, and may it always be so. Northern L Productions tweeting back to me at Deacon Punnett on Twitter. Also, Sophia Knight Warden and Jackie Boone, amongst the many people who were talking about this show, Zero Hour. So this came up during Open Lines, because Zero Hour with Anthony Edwards got canceled after only three episodes. So I was reading some of the reviews, and they're just terrible. They're beating up on the show so badly. But Sophia said, I know somebody who is an extra on Zero Hour. He actually thought it was awful. Says a lot, don't you think? Jacob said, actually, Ian, sci-fi is in bit of a drought on TV. Fringe had its finale in January. So good. Thank you for that correction. Becky said, Zero Hour's acting and or script writing was deplorable, which is too bad because the premise looked very promising. Brett said pretty much the same thing. Zero Hour was stupid. Acting was wooden, and the whole kidnapped wife thing driving the entire plot angle was so hackneyed. Ugh. Chris says, thanks for the Buffalo Springfield, and thank you, everybody, for staying in touch through Twitter. We'll do that again, tweeting regularly back and forth every other day or so, if you follow. But we'll also follow some of your questions, too. And if you want to tweet them in, I'll get to them before the end of the show, about disaster government. Brian Toohey reads the list of the 25 current national emergencies that are active right now. You just never heard of some of these. Coming up next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. All right, so again, find out more by going to our website, coasttocoastam.com, and link up to Brian Toohey and get this book launched right. Share it with other people, too. You'll be fascinated by the detail that that Brian has uncovered. And I want to get to another aspect of your subtitle here, not just about national emergencies, but also about the continuity of government story, because that's really compelling, especially during the 1980s. But let's go over the, what are currently listed as our national emergencies. You good with that?
Sure.
Okay. In order, then, the 25 national emergencies still actively declared and annually renewed by President Barack Obama. Some of these have been in place for, Brian, how long? What's the longest one on the list?
I think one goes back perhaps beyond Clinton to the first Bush administration.
All right. Go ahead. Here's the list.
I think I only have 24, by the way. I don't know if I have all 25.
We'll have another 25 before the half hour is over.
Exactly. Number one, we have terrorists who threaten the Middle East peace process, the situation in Cote d'Ivoire, Cuba, Zimbabwe. There's two relating to Iran. There's one relating to Somalia, Syria, the, quote, stabilization of Iraq, unquote, Burma, the Western Balkans, Belarus, North Korea, the risk of nuclear proliferation in the Russian Federation, the former Liberian regime of Charles Taylor, which if it's a former regime, you don't think it would be that threatening.
Yeah, really?
Lebanon, export control regulations, which is the one that has been around forever. Another North Korean one. There's one just, it's called certain terrorist attacks, which is actually an ongoing one from 9/11. Another one I'd love titled just persons who commit or threaten to commit or support terrorism. Then there's narcotic traffickers centered in Colombia, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Sudan, just another blanket one of weapons of mass destruction, and then Like I said, there's two Iranian ones, and there's actually three Iranian ones. I take that back.
You're missing the Chicago Cubs. Wasn't that on there too? Isn't that one of our national emergencies?
I think for President Obama, it'd be Rose not being on the polls. I think.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I think a lot of those have to be CIA driven, right? I mean, this is some sort of cover story for what the CIA is doing to give them some sort of legal cover in some of these. It just seems like it has clandestine operation written all over it.
Well, that's why I said I think a lot of this is almost like a pretext to some sort of military action, because the wording of the executive orders, and you can go online and find these. I mean, they're on the White House website, and then there's other websites that list all the executive orders out there. And people can read them, and that's what I did. I just started going through them and digging all these out. And you read them, they're very, like I say, just kind of bland. Just like there's a national emergency, this is the reason why. And it doesn't really say how they're going to effectively combat the national emergency. And, in fact, they don't effectively combat the national emergency, because, like, the whole list I read to you, all of those really, I think, date back to the Bush administration. So if after 5 years, how is it still an emergency?
Right. Except that except for the same reason, and this one of these great historical trivia questions, which you reference in the book, that World War II didn't actually end until the 1950s.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, what was the 50-51 for Japan and Germany?
Yeah, I think Germany was first, and then Japan was like a year or two later. Yeah, it was in the 50s.
But the reason why for that was because, at least in the case of Germany, and I don't know about Japan, but in Germany, that there was still a commitment from these cells, right, and from these lone wolves and from these guerrilla groups out there that were going to disrupt the peace. And they knew that they were still operating, or that they were, you know, theoretically, they were still trying to follow Nazis along the rat line or whatever, that there was still, at least you could see, like, there was some residual reason why they may have needed to have special powers in dealing in Germany. But that's I get that one. What I don't get is that I don't even think that we're in some of these countries where they're having a national emergency. Like, how can you be in a former government? Like the former government of Charles Taylor. You know what I mean?
We don't know we're in Zaire. We don't know, you know, we're in a lot of these places. Congo. It's an open invitation to do other things. And what those other things are remain to be seen. What the scary part is, I put in my book, which I think we'll talk about, is what the president can really do if he wanted to in the face of a national emergency.
Well, Brian, let me ask you, what can the president do if... if he or she wanted to, in the face of a national emergency?
Well, the really scary part is he could literally ration energy, food, and water in the United States. He could control the airwaves. He could confiscate your personal vehicle and control the airwaves, the auto waves, the waterways, and the airplane waves, if you want to, as well. He can control your personal electromagnetic device, including your iPod, your, you know, laptop computer and what have you. And he can literally force you to work on certain projects for a certain wage wherever they deem necessary in the event of a national emergency. And considering we're under 25 of them, you have to be a little worried.
Now, some people have gotten sidetracked, I think, in this conversation, and this has come up before on Coast to Coast, and gotten obsessed with FEMA and thinking of FEMA as being a government within a government, like a shadow government. And while there may be some truth to that, you don't need FEMA for the president to be able to do those things you just mentioned.
Well, you need someone, though. I mean, that's, I think, one of the safety nets we have in the country, is that because really all this paperwork, all this legislation, all these executive orders really literally set up a legal coup, a legal overthrow of the government if somebody wanted to take it that far. And all you would need is a national emergency as the tipping point to set all of this stuff in motion. What's holding it back is it would be very hard for President Obama to take over the United States based off what's going on in Zimbabwe.
Right.
Because I don't think a lot of people would rally around him and go, okay, sure. You would need some sort of major catastrophic event to really set all this stuff in motion and then for people to back them. But I think that's the key, is that FEMA, for example, I mean, there's only six, I think there's 6,000 employees that FEMA has nationwide. And we've seen it just in their ability to respond to a disaster like Hurricane Sandy. If you sent all 6,000 of those people to New York City after Hurricane Sandy, they would not have been able to help the 10 million plus people in need of relief. I mean, right. If you sent everybody, they wouldn't have been able to do it. I mean, I'm sorry. And so really, does FEMA need to exist? I don't think it does.
Well, and
I don't think it can handle the task because it's just not staffed that way and it's not run that way.
Well, and that proves my point. That again, I think FEMA becomes sort of a false positive. That you look at FEMA and you think, oh, then it's like some sort of shadow government, but it actually is fairly feeble. And if history tells us anything, the president can use almost any organization to implement these goals. So what was the thing that it's been a while since I read it, so help me with my memory on this. What was it that that Roosevelt found in some weird commerce clause that allowed the presidency to exploit? I mean, it was like some obscure, I dog-eared the page and I can go back and find it, but it was like literally like in the charter for why a government agency existed, they were able to use that to get around Congress telling the president no. And he found, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I vaguely remember it.
Let me see if I can find it.
The book, but it's the same thing. It was, if I remember right, you're talking about with Woodrow Wilson.
Yes, but it was.
FDR worked in the Department of Navy, and he found some sort of, like you said, it was in like an obscure law or regulation within the Navy that allowed the president, basically, I think it was to arm merchant ships.
That's what it was. It was to arm.
Not to do.
Right. After the Lusitania. And before our involvement in World War One, that was it. And so they used just the charter of this group to arm the ships. And he found something that had been not specific enough to stop him to do the justification, and just simply walked around Congress who had told him no.
Yeah. And that too was based off a national emergency. That was one that was declared by Wilson at the time that allowed them to do that as well. It was like, I think that was the wording, is he had to declare a national emergency for this to be allowable, and FDR found how to put all these together before he was even president, and then once he became president, he just took those ideas and ran with them to an extreme extent.
Well, obviously, we're seeing the same sort of debate again with the whole drone war question. Like, you know, can the president of the United States order a drone on domestic soil to kill a U.S. citizen? And on the surface of that, that may seem absurd. Like, of course the president can't do that. But got to find the law that actually says no. I mean, that the way the drone laws were written, maybe they were vague enough to allow for something like that.
Well, the hope is that the Constitution will rule above and beyond everything else. I don't think it is, unfortunately, but it should. I mean, you know, the right to due process and, you know, basically, was it the punishment clause as well? It should stop the president from being able to blow up somebody who's a suspected terrorist sitting in their house here in the United States. I mean, that's just the way it should be. Like, as they, you know, got on Rand Paul's case, some of the other congressmen said you shouldn't even have had to ask the question. Well, unfortunately, he did have to ask the question because he wasn't getting a straight answer.
Right.
And for him, that was concerning, and for a lot of other congressmen, it was concerning as well. But a lot of that, too, again, it almost goes back to this whole national emergency idea, whereas, you know, given this strange state of the war on terrorism we're in, it has kind of opened up the doors to a lot of things that the president and the government and the military, in fact, shouldn't be able to do, but we're kind of allowing them to do them just because apparently we're afraid of these people. And
well,
to me, it doesn't seem that of a frightening of an aspect, because I mean, you could commit terrorism in the United States very easily in a very small budget way, and yet nothing is occurring.
Right. Yeah. Although I think this is, it all comes down to, again, the political cowardice of our legislative branch, because they could get in the middle of any of these things if they had the guts to do it. I mean, Rand Paul's filibuster aside, Right. I mean, that's the lesson of history, is that Congress could roll up its sleeves and start to go through these executive orders, and they could demand a hearing, and they could do all sorts of stuff to get, but they're not interested in doing that. Definitely.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. Cause I mean, one of the things I bring up in the book is the National Emergency Act of 1976. And that was what they found at the time was the United States at that time was under four national emergencies. One dating all the way back from 1933 that FDR instituted. Another one, which was the Korean War, which that national emergency hadn't ended yet, and two that Nixon had implemented. And Congress at that time said, all right, we passed this National Emergency Act that's going to end these four national emergencies, and it's going to set up this rule for how national emergencies have to be declared. And once they're declared, you have to renew, a president would have to renew them, announce that he's renewing them at the end of every year. Now, that should have curtailed the usage of national emergencies. Instead, it exploded it.
Right.
I mean, it just went exponential afterwards, and it doesn't make sense why, because they did actually act, Congress acted, and, stopped what was going on, but instead it just created a whole new problem.
Well, I think this probably is a good time to transition into the continuity of government concept, and we can go back to national emergencies. Again, we're talking about the book Disaster Government, National Emergencies, Continuity of Government, and you, Brian Toohey, is the author. You can link up to this book by going to coasttocoastam.com. So, Brian, the continuity of government, or COG, as it's called, this is a concept which has been around for a long time. There's certain aspects and certain periods of this fixation on continuity of government, which can kind of stand out. Not everybody is fascinated with it, perhaps. And so you'll have to explain from the very beginning, when did this concept of continuity of government start, and who started to refine it to where it is today?
It basically was birthed after World War II, because if you believe the straight history that we were surprised with what happened at Pearl Harbor, after World War II, the federal government said, well, we can't let that happen again, and if it happens again, what if somebody attacked Washington, D.C.? What would we do? And so they started to create these plans and develop these relocation sites, they call them, which a lot of times are underground bases, to survive any sort of disaster or potential attack from an enemy. And that throughout the Cold War just built up and got more and more and more extreme. And the basic idea is very sound. It's if you want the government, basically what it is, you need the government to survive in order to protect the country and protect the citizens. And again, it's another double-edged sword, where if you think about it in saving the pure form of the American government, if you think about saving the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and the land of the free and the home of the brave and all that good stuff, continuity of government is a great idea. But a lot of people today see it kind of as a conspiracy theory, because what you're going to wind up saving is like the current administration and the current screwed up way this federal government seems to operate today. And that's the problem, is it's not necessarily saving the pure form, although that's what it's designed to do. It's basically going to save what we have.
Right. Or save a lot of lives of the more powerful congressmen.
Well, not necessarily, because one thing that was revealed on 9/11 was that because these plans developed over years and they spent billions of dollars on them, a lot of them are extremely top secret. And they're so top secret that members of Congress don't even know what the plan is. And
well,
that's problematic. If you're going to have a disaster plan, a plan to save everybody, a survival plan, and nobody knows what it is and nobody knows how to implement it, you have serious problems.
Yeah, but I thought that there was a reason why West Virginia was getting a lot of this underground bunker action and a lot of the secret sites were going to West Virginia because of certain powerful congressmen and senators from West Virginia that was steering it their way.
Well, that is true. But at the same time, one of the things I bring up in the book is that, and I forget the senator's name, I think it's DeFazio. He was on the Department of Homeland Security's oversight committee. And President Bush issued a bunch of continuity government orders and plans. And the senator wanted to read them, and he wasn't allowed access to them. Now, he's a senator. He's on the oversight committee for the Department of Homeland Security, which was put in charge of continuity government programs. And he's not allowed to see what's in these documents. Again, that's just wrong. And that's the thing is, I mean, on 9/11, when that occurred, there actually happened in Washington, D.C., to be a meeting of all the federal level judges, Supreme Court, the head of the circuit courts, basically the entire judiciary branch of the federal government was meeting on 9/11 in Washington, D.C., and the security came in, they grabbed the Chief Justice and left. They left the other eight Supreme Court members behind and everybody else behind, and they didn't tell anybody what was happening. And all the judges just slowly wandered out into the street to realize what was going on.
Yeah, it pays to be in the chain of command, I think, at that point. All right, well, then hang on for the sec, because I want to get back to then the COG, the continuity of government, as it was refined in the 80s under President Reagan. Very interesting. Disaster government, national emergencies, continuity of government, and you on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.